Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank, focused knowledge, customized solutions, and the resources of an entire bank. Because the best solutions fit around a business's needs. More at key.com/corporate. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The Chinese yuan ended trading today at 7.62 to the dollar. It's not like it really could have been anything else. Beijing keeps it within a pretty narrow range. And there's the rub, because all Congress can see is a $230 billion trade deficit, and all they can think is, we've got to do something. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SHRM and the Great Place to Work Institute, releasing the best small and medium companies to work for in America on June 25th at the SHRM Annual Conference and Exposition. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It's June 13th today. The U.S. trade deficit with China runs at just about $20 billion a month, each and every month of the year. It's a pretty simple formula. China's currency is relatively cheap against the dollar. That makes Chinese imports relatively cheap for American consumers. Catch is, it makes American exports relatively expensive for Chinese consumers. U.S. manufacturers and many politicians have been saying for years that's intentional, that Beijing keeps the yuan artificially low to get an unfair trading advantage. All the while, the White House has made noises like it sympathizes, but it hasn't really done anything to change the situation. So today, a bipartisan group of senators tried to make them. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
This morning, the Treasury Department officially labeled the Chinese yuan as undervalued. But many lawmakers and industry groups had been hoping that Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson would go further and declare that Beijing is manipulating its currency. But speaking last week, Secretary Paulson signaled he was reluctant to push China too hard.
I tend to be pretty pragmatic. I know what the sentiment is in China. I know what the sentiment is here. My objective is just to keep making progress.
But many lawmakers would like that progress to come a whole lot faster. So this afternoon, a bipartisan group of four senators, including Chuck Schumer of New York, introduced legislation designed to make it almost impossible for Treasury to avoid taking action.
And they're going to have to twist themselves in a pretzel.
Under the new bill, penalties aimed at China would include invoking anti-dumping provisions and unilaterally increasing those fines. That makes Stephanie Lester nervous. She represents retailers that benefit from cheap imports.
We don't want to prompt a trade war if we go down this path.
But other industry groups, especially manufacturers, signaled their support of the senator's proposal today. And the sponsors predict it will sail through Congress with a veto-proof majority. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The president said during his State of the Union back in January that he wants us to wean ourselves off foreign oil. What he didn't say was how tough that was going to be, practically and politically. Democrats on Capitol Hill are horse-trading their way toward a new energy bill. But Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk in the Senate, some controversial amendments are threatening to derail the whole thing.
Senators are voting on the easy stuff first, like requiring the government to come up with an oil savings plan. The hard stuff is still to come, like whether to subsidize the controversial coal-to-liquids industry. Coal state Democrats are pushing a $10 billion loan plan. Industry spokesman Corey Henry says government assistance will jumpstart production and ultimately benefit taxpayers.
Largely because they offer a very viable way for America to reduce its growing dependence on oil imported from unstable and unfriendly regimes.
But coal to liquids isn't exactly what some Democrats and many environmentalists consider green energy. Marchant Wentworth is with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
It's a very expensive process, both environmentally and economically. It's one of the worst ways to produce gasoline there is.
Other divisive proposals include raising fuel efficiency standards for cars by 40% and a mandate to pump up ethanol production. The powerful automobile lobby has objections to both. And when the energy bill gets to the House, it will face a powerful chairman, John Dingell of Michigan. He outraged environmentalists last week by circulating legislation that would bar the EPA and the states from regulating vehicle emissions. Political analyst Tom Mann says it's a sign of the fight to come.
Individual members and groups of members, certainly within the Democratic Party, are going to be resisting moving too far too fast.
And that suggests, Mann says, that the energy bill that ultimately emerges will be much more modest in reach than many had hoped. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Go ahead and give yourself a pat on the back if you bought something last month, because once again, the American consumer is riding to the economic rescue. The retail sales report out this morning showed sales up 1.4% in May. It gave Wall Street an early lift, but consultant Howard Davidowitz figures there's less to those numbers than meets the eye.
The consumer has debt over their heads, cannot refinance their homes. Their mortgage is going up, their food costs are going up, their gas prices are going up. The consumer is underwater, and retail sales are weak for the first 4 months of this year.
Howard cautioned against getting too excited about 1 month's worth of data.
It would be a gigantic mistake because the consumer continues weak.
But then again, Wall Street's never been a place where cooler heads prevailed. A rally in the bond market, remember that's when prices rise and yields fall, helped improve the mood quite a bit from the past couple of days. And then about 2 this afternoon, East Coast time, the Federal Reserve came out with its semi-regular report on the economy. It's known as the Beige Book. And it said the obligatory things about strength in some areas, but then it also added that there are no real inflationary pressures. And with that, investors went on a buying spree. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The White House has launched a full-on press to get the immigration bill back on track. The president took a swing up to Capitol Hill yesterday for lunch with Republican senators, and the administration has dispatched Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff and Secretary of Commerce Carlos Gutierrez to lobby for the bill. Secretary Gutierrez says he's calling businesses, Latino groups, anybody he can to try to get their support. When we spoke earlier today, I asked him to give me the sales pitch.
Well, it depends. You know, if we're talking to business groups, what we're saying is if we don't get this through, you're not going to have legal labor. And we're going to have a hard time finding enough workers for our economy. That's something that a lot of people have not wanted to recognize. But our estimate is that unemployment among the legal population is actually below the average of the unemployment of the whole country. So what that says is that the reason they're here is because they have a job. And if they weren't here, that job would still be here.
You and Secretary Chertoff from Homeland Security spent months up on Capitol Hill working on this bill. Did you miscalculate when you came down with it and its reception was not what you'd expected?
We always knew that this is the kind of bill that no one got everything. Everyone got a little bit. So no one was going to be totally happy. But that is the nature of finding a bipartisan compromise. So we knew it would be very controversial.
Speaking of bipartisan, sir, it's not only Republicans who have had some problems with its bill. It's been Democrats as well. They've complained about the guest worker program. Where do you think that might wind up?
Well, we need a guest worker program. You know, if you go back and look at one of the mistakes of the 1986 bill, we did not have a guest worker program. So what happened is that those jobs, instead of being filled through a guest worker program, that void was filled through illegal immigration. So we need a way to be able to bring in people on a temporary basis.
You know, you can go down the list of items in this bill, and it's tough to find something that somebody didn't object to. And the next one that comes to my mind is the move away from family-based immigration toward a point system, rewarding people with skills and marketable opportunities here. Is there talk in the White House of perhaps changing that dynamic?
No, we think that that's important. I mean, we've had this chain migration for a while now. Today, about 65% of the green cards that we give out are family-based. Part of the bill includes getting rid of the green card backlog, the family backlog, in 8 years. So during that eight-year time, about 74% of the green cards that we give out will be family-based, 74%. So the first 8 years of this bill, there'll be a surge in family unification. After that, after we get to this policy that we're talking about, it'll be about 51%. You know, we're not moving away from family. We're just balancing it out, and we believe that the economy deserves to have a higher portion that is employment-based, that is based on the skills that our country needs.
Something's going to have to give, though, sir, to get this bill back on the floor and eventually passed. What's it going to be? What's the sticking point that you're going to have to get by?
Well, first of all, people need to get more comfortable with it. And what's been happening is, I don't know how many people have read the bill. It's a 380-page bill, but a lot of it has been one-liners and rhetoric, and you can't really get to know what this bill is all about without really understanding it. And if somebody says, well, this is amnesty, then that's all people need to hear. So I think there's been a lot of work and a lot of education work to ensure that people understand the bill. In terms of the amendments, we have some amendments left to go. I hope that those amendments are enough to get it through the Senate. And then the House will be, you know, we'll start over with the House, and that will be another major ordeal, but I'm sure we'll get it there as well.
Carlos Gutierrez, the Secretary of Commerce. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much, sir.
The other half of the White House lobbying team, Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff, was on Capitol Hill today talking about immigration. He was playing to the political side of the debate, promising tighter border security. But those borders aren't just the land crossings. Since 1965, virtually anybody coming here from Cuba has been admitted as a refugee. Since 1994, though, only those who actually set foot on dry American soil get to stay. Anybody caught at sea is sent home. So many Cuban migrants no longer take a boat to Florida. Legia Navarro explains what they're doing now.
You're in Cuba without a visa to the U.S. and you want out. What do you do? With all the stories of capsized boats, hopping a raft isn't too appealing. There is one much easier way, if you have family abroad, that is. Just have your relatives pay 11 grand and a smuggler will come get you. This man we'll call Manuel did just that.
Empezamos a caminar entre la maleza, bueno mojado, húmedo.
We walked through the jungle, wet and tired, until we got to the place near the coast where we waited for the smugglers to come pick us up.
The smugglers' boat didn't point north to Miami, but due west to Mexico. That's the latest change in tactic for Cuban-American people smugglers, says Miami Customs and Border Protection spokesman Zach Mann.
But what we're seeing now is Cubans making their way to Mexico and then making their way across the southwest border into the United States.
Since 2005, there's been a major U.S. crackdown on smuggling through Florida after smuggling numbers increased and several migrants died in chases with the Coast Guard. Now Mexico is the most popular route for Cubans entering the United States illegally. Last year, nearly 9,000 Cubans showed up at the U.S.-Mexico border. That's about triple the number that landed on Florida beaches. Again, Zach Mann.
And now it's become an organized business, and they're really the only goal really is to make a profit.
The smugglers who picked Manuel up loaded 34 Cubans onto a luxury speedboat, netting about $375,000. The cost of a smuggling trip includes transportation right to the U.S.-Mexico border. Once Cubans get to the border, almost all are let across, even if they're economic migrants. That's drastically different from U.S. policy towards other illegal immigrants, says sociologist Lisandro Perez.
It's a sort of a contradiction. It says, as long as you can escape, we'll welcome you. And essentially, if you do something sometimes risky that will bring you here, we will admit you.
Many Cubans are smuggled through the Mexican resort city of Cancun, where they're kept in safe houses and then shuttled north. Manuel was flown from Cancun to the northern Mexican city of Monterrey, an hour from Texas.
When we got to the airport, they gave us the tickets, but the names on them weren't our names. They were fake.
But it didn't matter, because no one asked Manuel to show ID before he boarded the plane. That's because smugglers pay off officials in Mexico's immigration agency, the National Migration Institute, says Cancun's top federal prosecutor, Pedro Ramirez Violante.
What is most alarming is that some of the cases that have arisen have come about with the aid of the National Immigration Institute's personnel. In this case, clearly people who are charged with guarding that these types of things don't happen.
Ramirez Violante says that without law enforcement information from the immigration agency, his office hasn't been able to prosecute a single smuggler of Cubans. In Miami's Little Havana, where exile groups lobby fiercely to influence U.S. policy towards Cuba, few will say the smuggling's all bad. Camila Ruiz is the spokesperson for the Cuban American National Foundation.
Though we understand it's illegal and we don't agree with that, we do understand the desperation that drives Cubans to try to find any kind of vehicle to get out of Cuba.
But once Cubans do get out illegally, they're barred from going back. Manuel hopes that someday his parents will get visas to come see him. For now, he works plenty of overtime to send money to them and repay the debt he and his relatives racked up paying to get him to the U.S. In Miami, I'm Ligia Navarro for Marketplace.
Funding for that story was provided by the Dick Goldenson Fund at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Coming up, farm workers grow their own businesses.
I mean, it's a genuine excitement. I mean, when you get excited about food, that shows in the food and that translates to the customer.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials roared back 187 points today, 1.4% to close at 13,482. The Nasdaq restored 32 points, 1.25%, finished trading at 2582. The S&P 500 advanced 22 points, 1.5% there, wrapped up the day at 1515. Those encouraging retail sales numbers we told you about helped lift shares of the world's biggest retailer, Walmart. They rang in nearly 1.25% higher. Stock at Home Depot spruced up by 1%. It was a blockbuster day for Blockbuster Video. Shares in the movie rental chain jumped more than 8% on an analyst upgrade. Netflix shares fell more than 3.25% on news that its rival, Blockbuster, will be offering cheaper online rentals. Bond prices rose. That pushed the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 5.2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the May Producer Price Index. The Mortgage Bankers Association reports on its latest National Mortgage Delinquency Survey. And in the competitive world of today's reality TV, you could get worked over by Simon Cowell, but in the past, you could have gotten the gong. The Gong Show premiered on June 14, 1976. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The State Department has decided to offer at least a partial refund to some of those who've been caught up in passport pandemonium. If you paid an extra $60 to get expedited service but still got your passport late, you can apply by mail for your money back. The whole mess is because of those new rules that were supposed to go into effect last week, that everybody who goes abroad would need a passport, even for travel to Canada, Mexico, and the Caribbean. The State Department has relaxed those rules while it digs out from under a mountain of passport applications. But the trouble is, the temporary fix isn't working for everybody. And in the process, a lot of people are losing a lot of money. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
You can still be bumped from your flight even if you do just what the State Department's been saying. If you're traveling to or from Canada, Mexico, or the Caribbean,
U.S. citizens must have a government-issued photo identification
and Department of State official proof of application for a passport.
What that official website presentation doesn't say is foreign countries have their own entry rules. Mexico requires a birth certificate if you don't have a passport. That's proving to be a catch-22 if you've sent off your birth certificate along with your passport application. Several airlines have stopped some ticket holders from boarding this week. A spokesman for Delta told us the bumping was done to save the passengers from the inevitable hassle at their destination. David Field, U.S. editor of Airline Business Magazine, says the carriers are also protecting themselves.
The airline carries a person to a foreign country, and the foreign country refuses to admit them. The airline has to carry the person back at its own expense. So they've been burned by that before.
Field says the industry's fine print makes the traveler responsible for all proper documentation, even if you've tried but failed to get a passport in time. The State Department also concedes some passport applicants aren't showing up in its computer system. They got bumped because they couldn't print out the proof required under the new rules. If all else fails, Field suggests try groveling for a voucher or, if you're lucky, a refund.
Rather than arguing or screaming at the airline person, try to be nice and maybe they'll show you some sympathy.
Indeed, that may be your only recourse. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It seems there are no exceptions to passport complications, not even for a former high-ranking federal official like commentator Robert Reich.
I wasn't worried about getting a new passport in time for my Canadian trip because the passport office's webpage assured me that a new one would arrive in 6 weeks, 8 weeks maximum. 9 weeks later, and still without a passport, I phoned the local passport office. I should say I tried to phone. No one answered. So I tried the national passport line in Washington and got a recording saying that due to unprecedented volume, they could serve me only if I was leaving the country within 2 weeks. I qualified, but that hardly seemed to matter. I was patched through to a 24-hour automated line that informed me I couldn't be connected because of the high volume of calls and advised me to call back at night. I phoned back that night, but no one answered. In the meantime, I learned from a friend about a private company that sped up the process by hand-delivering passport applications to appropriate government offices. But that would cost another $100 on top of my original $97 fee and mean starting the process all over again. Trying to control my rising anxiety, I phoned my representative in Congress and finally got through to a sympathetic human being who said they were getting a lot of calls about passports. She'd do what she could. Apparently, it's been like this ever since a new law went into effect last January, requiring passports for Americans returning by air from Canada, Mexico, Bermuda, and the Caribbean. The State Department reportedly hired dozens of new workers to process the anticipated flood of applications, which is laughable. They didn't need dozens. They needed thousands. Late last week, faced with rising tempers, the government announced a temporary suspension of the new passport requirement. To go to Canada next week, all I need is proof I've applied for a passport. But when I went online to get the proof, there was a notice saying it's taking a week for passport applications to be tracked online. I don't know whether I'll get to Canada, but I doubt any of this has made it harder for terrorists to enter America. All we've done is make it harder for Americans to leave.
Being a former Secretary of Labor for President Clinton didn't help Bob Reich any in trying to get his passport problem straightened out. If you're looking for information on how to get that refund we were talking about, there's a link on our website. It's marketplace.org. And while you're there, send us your comments. Click on the link that says contact. Working your way up the corporate ladder is never easy. It's even harder when you start in the dirt. Actual dirt, I mean. Farm workers usually start and end their careers in the same kinds of jobs, doing backbreaking work for somebody else. A training program in Salinas, California is trying to change that, as Rachel McDonald reports.
Laurentino Piazza steps off a tractor on a windy afternoon. He's been turning over organic alfalfa that was put in last winter. He learned organic farming methods here at the Agriculture and Land-Based Training Association, or ALBA. When he first came 12 years ago, he'd spent a decade cutting and packing lettuce in the fields of Salinas. Now he's ALBA's farm manager.
I like a farm and teach other farms, other laborers to become this program.
But maybe not for long. Caiazzo and his wife Maria have decided to set up on their own.
It's an American dream to get a piece of land. It's not easy. It's hard. because the loans now is difficult to get.
The Cayazos did get a loan from the California Coastal Rural Development Corporation. That, along with financing from the previous owner and their own savings, added up to $250,000. It was enough to buy 10 acres of farmland about 70 miles south of the Alba farm.
Absolutely changed my life.
Cayazo is not the only Alba success story. 16 more farmers graduated from the small farming course this spring. Six of them are starting their own farms. Alba director Gary Peterson says that's a goal, to help bring farm workers out of poverty, move them from the role of laborer to farmer.
When you're talking about a context where farm workers typically earn less than $20,000 a year in this region and throughout California, when you're presenting an opportunity for people to earn a gross income of more than $10,000 per acre, it becomes a pretty significant opportunity.
Peterson says the key with small farming operations is to find direct marketing opportunities, to cut out the number of middlemen between farmer and consumer. Alba farmers sell organic produce to a number of area restaurants and businesses. Like the Asilomar Conference Center in nearby Pacific Grove, California. In the kitchen, a cook chops organic yellow squash for the evening meal. Chef Colin Moody says he was inspired to buy produce from Alba after a recent organic farming conference. He says he gets almost half his fruits and vegetables from Alba Farms.
I've always thought what you put into the food is what you get out of it, and it all starts with the farmer and how they're caring for their product and what goes into it. And what they feel about it. I mean, it's a genuine excitement. I mean, when you get excited about food, that shows in the food and that translates to the customer.
Moody says working with Alba has changed the way he plans his menus. Now he creates dishes based on what's available locally. And he says the prices for Alba's local veggies are often lower than those at his usual distributor in San Francisco. Alba is also trying to get its organic veggies to low-income families. It has a farm stand at Sacred Heart Church in Salinas. On Sunday mornings, churchgoers can pick up organic vegetables after Mass. Seller Alex Sunsen.
Everything is delicious, everything is fresh, and everything is organic.
Back at Alba, savvy farmer Florentino Cayazo says he's planning to grow fruits that are harder to find in the cool coastal areas, like peaches and pomegranates.
Many farm market in this area wanted the fruits, because the people almost always asking about that. Oh, where is a peach?
Cayazo hasn't planted anything yet. He's still cleaning up his new farmland. It's hard work, but he's used to that. And in future, like other successful graduates of the Alba course, he'll reap the profits himself. In Salinas, California, I'm Rachel McDonald for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we go, the parent company of Airbus unveiled plans today for a jet that will rocket tourists into space. Astrium, that's a division of the European plane maker Eads, says it hopes to blast off from a local airport, spend 3 minutes at the final frontier, and come home all within a half an hour. If it works, it'll be a boost for a company that's been struggling to get the super jumbo A380 off the ground and to its customers. Tickets off the planet are projected to cost around $200,000, so start saving now. The first flights are planned for 2012. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Events conspired today to send the Dow up 187 points, 1.4%. The NASDAQ leaped 32 points, that's 1.5%. The S&P 500 rose 22 points, 1.5% there as well. Next time on the program, fitting in can be sort of hard sometimes, you know?
Women like to be liked, and they want to be accepted by social groups. And making declarative statements is kind of intimidating.
Here's a declarative statement. I'm Kai Rizdal, and I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.